Ahead of an expected Israeli incursion into Rafah, negotiations continue.
This particular negotiation has had its ups and downs, its ins and outs, its twists and turns. And what I laid out in my opening comments remains the case. There could be a ceasefire tomorrow if Hamas would just go ahead and release women, wounded, and elderly.
Plus, Secretary of State Antony Blinken visits Kyiv.
The assistance is now on the way. Some of it's already arrived. More of it will be arriving. And that's going to make a real difference against the ongoing Russian aggression on the battlefield.
And later, a look ahead to Vladimir Putin's trip to China and a look at the Indian election from Pakistan. Today is Tuesday, May 14th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. Washington says it's working to resolve the many issues in the continuing conflict in Gaza as negotiations continue, but Israel plans to launch a full-scale operation in the southern city of Rafah over U.S. objections. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
The grief of thousands of people underscores world leaders' urgent attempts to end the war in Gaza after more than 7 months. Fear hangs over the people of Gaza as they scramble for safety under the shadow of a threatened full Israeli offensive into the crowded city of Rafah. And growing youth anger over the unceasing violence has inflamed American universities and spread beyond the shores of the U.S. At this delicate point, the White House said Monday that Washington is still plugging away at negotiations in Cairo aimed at securing the release of hostages and a truce. Jake Sullivan is National Security Advisor.
This particular negotiation has had its ups and downs, its ins and outs, its twists and turns. And what I laid out in my opening comments remains the case. There could be a ceasefire tomorrow if Hamas would just go ahead and release women, wounded, and elderly. We do believe Israel has put a good proposal on the table. Hamas has put a counterproposal on the table. The world is calling for a ceasefire. Those who are doing so should go to Hamas and say, come to the table and work until we get a deal.
And he acknowledged to VOA, there are new fissures in that process. Egypt, which is hosting the negotiations, recently came out in support of South Africa's International Court of Justice case against Israel for genocide.
I can't say that it's helpful to the discussions between Egypt and Israel to try to sort out the humanitarian assistance and access issues, but I do know that Egypt, Israel, the United States, the United Nations, we are all trying to work together to figure out a way forward.
Analysts say Washington's message is also muddled, especially on Israel's plans to mount a major military operation in the southern Gaza city of Rafah. Sullivan said Monday that Israel has conducted only targeted strikes there so far. David Makovsky is a Ziegler Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute and director of the Korup Project on Arab-Israel Relations.
There's been some mixed signals from the administration. Sometimes it seems like they're against anything in Rafah. Sometimes they say, no, we're not against, but we just haven't seen the right sort of plan. So I think that this needs to be clarified.
Meanwhile, as Washington tries to make a clear plan, Israel's leadership faces pressure from citizens who accuse Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of fanning the flames of Palestinian violence. Nir Galan is a Tel Aviv-based businessman.
Just wanted to emphasize to Prime Minister Netanyahu his responsibility for what happened here on October 7th.
Meanwhile, as officials try to talk their way to peace, Israel strikes on Gaza continue. Anita Powell, VOA News, The White House.
Israeli forces have pushed deep into the ruins of Gaza's northern edge on Monday to recapture an area from Hamas fighters, while in the south, tanks and troops pushed across a highway towards Rafah, leaving Palestinians scrambling to find safety. Reuters' Ryan Chang has the story.
Civilian casualties continue to tick up as Israel stepped up its assault in the northern and southern parts of Gaza on Monday. Rescue crews brought in badly wounded civilians, some of them children, to a hospital in northern Beit Lahia. Some of the most intense fighting for weeks is raging in both the north and south. Israeli forces had gone back into Jabalia, where they've said they have dismantled Hamas months ago to prevent militants regrouping there. A medical worker, Faraz Afna, says they've tried to reach the Jabalia camp. Bodies were recovered there after overnight strikes. But he claims Israeli forces had been targeting ambulance crews, blocking them from saving wounded and trapped civilians. In southern Gaza's Rafah, streets were near empty as Palestinians fled the fighting. Israel on Monday cut across a main highway into Rafah, closing a main crossing point for aid. The UN says a foreign security staff member was killed on Monday when a UN-marked vehicle traveling to a hospital in Rafah was struck. This marks the first international UN fatality in the Gaza war. Hamas's armed wing says, due to Israeli bombardments, it lost contact with militants guarding four Israeli hostages. Supplies are also wearing thin for many displaced Palestinians who fled the northern south to Deir Abala in the center of the Gaza Strip.
There is not enough water for all displaced people. There is not enough food, not enough markets for everyone. This water tank that you see, this was barely enough for those who were already here. It was already not enough, but we were living with it. So what about those who joined us? There are people from two camps in addition to our camp.
The UN says around 360,000 people have fled Rafah since Israel's evacuation order a week ago. Many uprooted families are moving to empty tracts of land along the coast, but the UN warns of poor sanitary conditions there. Starving Palestinians on one side of the border and on the other, Israeli protesters blocking aid trucks to Gaza on Monday. Some Israelis were seen spilling contents of the trucks onto a road at a West Bank checkpoint, the second such incident in less than a week. This comes even as Israel has pledged to allow uninterrupted humanitarian supplies into the besieged enclave. Washington, which has paused some deliveries of weapons to Israel as it disagrees with an assault on Rafah, has denounced looting these convoys.
That's Ryan Chang of Reuters reporting for us today. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Ukraine on Tuesday on an unannounced visit. Blinken said that his visit aims to demonstrate U.S. continuous support for Ukraine. VOA's Anna Chernikova has more from Kyiv.
He has already met with President Zelensky. The two discussed the situation at the front line, the new Russian assault in the Kharkiv region, and U.S. participation in the peace summit in June. The Ukrainian president said it will be very important for Ukraine that President Biden participates in the summit.
And of course I want to discuss security guarantees, how our teams work on it, and peace summit, which is very important for us. We need participation not only United States. We need President Biden and also your help to involve as much as possible countries to peace summit.
Blinken will also deliver a statement where he is expected to address how the United States and other allies and partners will help Ukraine achieve its goal of building a free, prosperous and secure democracy, fully integrated into Europe and transatlantic alliance.
The assistance is now on the way. Some of it's already arrived. More of it will be arriving. And that's going to make a real difference against the ongoing Russian aggression on the battlefield. And we're determined, along with many other partners for Ukraine, to make sure that you succeed on the battlefield. We're equally determined that over time, Ukraine stands strongly on its own feet, militarily, economically, democratically. A strong, successful, thriving, free Ukraine is the best possible rebuke to Putin, and the best possible guarantor for your future.
More details and a complete report on Blinken's visit to Ukraine will come on Wednesday's show. Meanwhile, intensive battles continue in the Kharkiv region as Russian forces are trying to advance to the city of Kharkiv. According to the Ukrainian military, Russian forces have a greater advantage in manpower and equipment, but Ukrainian forces are holding their defensive lines amid the Russian advances within the so-called gray zone, 6 kilometers from the border. Ukrainian intelligence chief Kirill Budanov reported that though the situation in the Kharkiv region remains tough, it has been partially stabilized and Ukrainian defense forces have had some success. The U.S. State Department said that the Russian forces will try to advance in the Kharkiv region, but the American side does not expect serious breakthroughs in this area. At the same time, the evacuation of local residents from villages and towns in the border zone continues in the Kharkiv region and also began in the Sumy region, as there are fears that Russian forces can try to attack the border areas there as well. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Not all diplomacy takes place around a conference room table in an embassy or government building. Ukrainian Minister of Foreign Affairs Dmytro Kuleba apparently likes to conduct some important meetings in restaurants. On Blinken's last trip to Kyiv, the two ate at McDonald's. Today, they had pizza.
I'm pleased to inform you that we enjoyed two Ukrainian pizzas. Mm-hmm. One of them is actually called Ukrainian. And we had a productive conversation over this meal. Last time, Tony and I went to McDonald's in Kyiv, which reopened its doors in Ukraine. But some people criticized me on social media that I took you to McDonald's, not to Ukrainian place. So now we are correcting this and complimenting McDonald's with a pizza place that was founded by Ukrainian veterans and became a legendary place already. I hope you enjoyed the pizzas because you definitely have more experience in frying pies all over the world.
For his part, Blinken said he liked the pizza, but I think he also appreciated getting out of the office and seeing some of the city as well.
Well, I have to say, as somewhat of a knowledgeable person about pizza, as most Americans are, the pizza here is superb. I highly, highly recommend it. The Ukrainian pizza, as you called it, was excellent. Could not have been better. And look, I think it's appropriate that, yes, we went to McDonald's last time. Now we're at a Ukrainian pizza place. Next time we'll have to figure out what cuisine to try, but I couldn't be more pleased that my friend has taken me on this culinary tour of Kyiv that I expect to continue in the months and years ahead. Thank you. Thank you.
The pizza restaurant the two dined at is owned and staffed by Ukrainian war veterans and regularly delivers free pizzas to other veterans who are undergoing treatment in local hospitals. You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Russian President Vladimir Putin is headed to China later this week. We'll find out what we can expect from their meeting in a moment. Now, we go approximately 3,000 kilometers due north of Kyiv, well above the Arctic Circle, to the Norwegian town of Svalbard. Last week, we heard how Ukrainians and Russians were, or weren't, getting along, living side by side in a small mining village on the island. Now, analysts say Russia is adopting a so-called hybrid approach to growing its strategic influence in the Arctic through research, increased maritime activities, and tourism. For the inhabitants of one remote Norwegian community, the announcement of a new boat bringing tourists from Russia means more than just a few extra visitors. Henry Wilkins reports from Svalbard, Norway.
Because of Svalbard's unusual legal framework, countries other than Norway that are signatories to the century-old Svalbard Treaty are allowed to carry out economic activity here. Russia announced in April it would be sending its own boat, carrying tourists to the island. Norway's presence in Svalbard means it could potentially deny Russia's northern fleet access to the Atlantic in the event of a conflict. For that reason, analysts say, Russia maintains a presence on the island, which it's entitled to, primarily in the form of Barentsburg, a town of some 400 mostly Russian and Ukrainian people. Most military activity on Svalbard is banned under the treaty, but analysts say Russia is adopting a so-called hybrid approach to growing its influence here. That means gradually developing legitimate activities like research, industry, and tourism, and increasing its maritime presence, ultimately for strategic aims. One academic says some have noticed a recent ramping up of Russia's rhetoric around Svalbard too. Arild Moe, senior research fellow at the Fridtjof Nansen Institute.
Well, first of all, there have been these declarations, an official Russian declaration, which have been very critical on Norway, alleging that Norway is militarizing the islands, running NATO's errand, and so on. Quite strong wording, which is, of course, interpreted by people in it as a very hostile.
John Fidger Hoffman, an assistant to the governor of Svalbard, a member of Norway's police security service, told VOA there are frequent minor infringements of regulations by Russians on the island. including misuse of helicopters, which should only be used to assist mining, and
the driving around with the vehicles in Barentsburg with Russian number plates instead of the Norwegian official number plates that they are supposed to have.
In May of 2023, inhabitants of Barentsburg organized a Russian Victory Day procession, which many locals here say had militaristic overtones. This year, Svalbard's governor said celebrations were significantly more subdued after last year's caught global media attention. Hoffman says,
whether this is because they've figured that out themselves or if somebody has from Moscow said that it's better to have a more modest celebration, we don't know.
The Russian special consul in Barentsburg, who, according to a 2023 investigation by the Norwegian broadcaster NRK, is an operative for Russian military intelligence, declined a request for interview. With Russia working to grow its influence across the Arctic, and its bases in the region now outnumbering NATO's 3-1, its proposed tourist boat to Svalbard is likely just the tip of the iceberg. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Longyearbyen, Norway.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin heads to China later this week for a summit with President Xi Jinping. As Putin looks for more support for his war in Ukraine, Xi is weary of alienating Western trading partners. For a closer look, I'm joined by Anita Kellogg. She's an assistant professor at the National Defense University.
This visit comes right after Xi has made several overtures to and met with several European leaders, including most recently Macron, in order to, you know, help further his need to continue economic growth through export-led growth. For Russia, though, this relationship is also very important. And, you know, in challenging the West and keeping attention divided in the West.
Now, China and Russia have what they call a no-limits partnership. So What is Vladimir Putin looking for from his friend, President Xi?
I think it's really interesting that this visit happens right after the shakeup in the defense ministry, where now an economist will be leading the defense ministry and kind of showing how important the industrial military complex is to Russia's economy. And so they very much need the support from Russia economically, which has really struggled under Western sanctions, and to continue to support sort of the parts that go in dual use technology that goes into making Russian armaments and equipment. So this is very important, boosting energy ties, economic ties. Russia has a lot to gain and very much needs this meeting.
So I think it can be safely said that both Russia and China sort of see themselves as pushing against American dominance, particularly in the Pacific and South Pacific. What do you think might come out of this meeting in relation to, say, Taiwan or the South China Sea or any of the security issues we're seeing in that part of the world?
I don't think you'll see a substantial change in the security issues in Asia, but I think the Russian war with Ukraine is important to China, as I said, because it keeps the West's attention at least divided between the conflicts so that it's not able to give its full attention to the challenges in Asia. But of course, there will probably be token support, but Russia is not in a position to alter that in any way.
And also, as we learned today, China looks like it could be facing some trade tariffs from the United States. Do you think China might be turning towards Russia to compensate for some of that?
Yes, definitely. Although I think the relationship with Russia is much more dependent on China, but China definitely is under a lot of pressure from the West, particularly the United States. And boosting these economic ties is good for China, which has struggled a little bit with its economy most recently and certainly needs the market for the export of its goods.
So final question for you, Ms. Kellogg. What do you see when this meeting is over? Will anything change or just the status quo be solidified?
I think mostly the status quo would be solidified, but you might see some, certainly you'll see a statement about economic ties, strengthening those ties. And you might see more closer industrial competition, industrial support for the economy in Russia. Although I think to some extent that's a little bit limited by the kind of sanctions that the U.S. most recently put on some Chinese companies supporting parts dual-use technology to Russia.
Anita Kellogg is an assistant professor at the National Defense University. Anita, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
And finally, today, as India goes to the polls, Pakistan is closely watching. Islamabad is annoyed that Indian politicians have taken a tough stance on Pakistan to woo voters. VOA's Pakistan bureau chief Sarah Zaman explores how campaign rhetoric might impact the already rocky ties between the two neighbors.
Machines at Serena Textile Industries near Pakistan's eastern city Lahore produce fabrics for some of the country's biggest brands and businesses across the globe. But Pakistan's eastern neighbor India, one of the world's largest markets, is off limits.
We will get cheaper raw materials, which we were getting before the trade embargo. Finer fabrics, our lawns and our cambrics and cottons, are very well liked in India.
Islamabad suspended trade with India in August 2019 after New Delhi unilaterally ended the autonomous status of the disputed Jammu and Kashmir territory. Pakistani businesses want Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif's new government to resume trade ties in a bid to ease economic pain. But as India goes to the polls, Prime Minister Narendra Modi is presenting himself as tough compared to the main opposition party Congress in cracking down on Pakistan's alleged cross-border terror activities.
As soon as I came to power, I said enough is enough. Today, Pakistan is complaining to the world and crying, save us, save us.
Partitioned in 1947, the two nuclear-armed nations have fought multiple wars and routinely accuse each other of cross-border terrorism. Pakistani experts say Indian politicians can't afford to look soft on Pakistan.
Congress, they are labeling Modi as the close friend of Mr. Sharif in Pakistan. So this is a pattern. They are addressing to extremist voters, especially the BJPs, and they are point scoring that we would be hard and we would be harsh on Pakistan.
BJP is the Modi-led Bharatiya Janata Party. As Modi eyes a historic third term in office, some in Pakistan think he may choose the path of peace despite sounding like a hawk.
So if he is to go down history, he has to leave some legacy. So I see that a chance for Modi to make his name in terms of making peace with Pakistan.
Islamabad recently urged Indian politicians to stop dragging Pakistan into what the Foreign Office called India's populist public discourse. Experts say Pakistan bashing may woo some Indian voters, but expect that post-election, governments on both sides will put campaign rhetoric behind and work quietly to try to resolve issues. Zaman's profits would soar if he could trade with India, but he's not hopeful of a breakthrough if Modi, a Hindu nationalist, returns.
From the past 10 years that he's been in power, it does not give rise to a lot of optimism being a Muslim and a Pakistani.
Sara Zaman, VOA News, Islamabad.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.